Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Friday, the 13th of February. Today on Wall Street, there's unhappiness at the lack of clarity in the US Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner's scheme to ease the financial crisis.
In this rather complex and opaque plan, there is an issue of stress testing all the banks. So he's going to go into each one and see just how bad the situation is.
In the UK, Gordon Brown takes questions from the Commons watchdog over his handling of the economy.
He knew his facts, he was assured, he was confident, and he wasn't really ruffled by the questions.
And Washington watches as Israel's parties continue their horse trading in an attempt to form a coalition government.
I think there's also frustration that there isn't one decent leader in this country that people really feel profoundly attracted to or supportive of.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But before we hear about any of that, here's Sandy Waugh with the news and a whiz through the papers.
A commuter plane has crashed into a house in Upper State, New York, USA. The house has been completely destroyed and fire crews are fighting a blaze at the scene in Buffalo. It's feared that all on board the 50-seater plane have been killed, and it's believed there were more than 30 passengers as well as four crew. The Continental Airways plane was flying into the town from Newark, New Jersey, and came down 6 miles short of the airport in a suburb of Buffalo. In Australia, one man has been charged with starting one of the many fires that swept the southern state of Victoria. He's been accused of arson causing death for lighting a fire that killed 21 people near the town of Churchill. Firefighters are still trying to put out all the fires, helped by light rain in cooler weather. But they have had to move people out of another town, Healesville, where the blaze has flared up again. Another British banker is fighting shy of public criticism. After the resignation of the deputy chairman of the Financial Services Authority, the man looking after the government bank bailout fund has said he doesn't want the job full time. Glenn Marino is filling in as chairman of the company looking after the £37 billion bank bailout. He's been questioned for being a trustee of a private bank accused of aiding tax evasion, the Liechtenstein Global Trust. This week, Sir James Crosby resigned from the FSA after being accused of sacking a man who warned of the credit crisis. In the USA, the Republican senator nominated to be Commerce Secretary by the Democratic President Obama has withdrawn. Judge Gregg of New Hampshire said he'd made a mistake because he disagreed over the economic stimulus bill. There were too many irresolvable conflicts. President Obama said he was sorry, but that Gregg had originally approached him. We'll have more on the president's difficulties with his stimulus plan later in the program. And finance ministers from the seven longest established industrial nations are meeting in Rome. Britain's Alistair Darling will be joining his colleagues from the G7 group to try to lay out an international response to the recession. There'll be proposals to the G20 meeting in London in the spring, which includes the major emerging economies of China, India and Brazil. This morning's papers head in many different directions, but a couple do want to tell you about what the Mail calls the high life for Sir Humphrey when it reveals the extraordinary freebies enjoyed by Britain's mandarins. The Guardian says Sir Brian Bender is a top Whitehall mandarin, so what was he doing above a series of pictures of Wimbledon, Ascot and the Chelsea Flower Show? The Times says mandarins challenged on hospitality culture. The Guardian gives pride of space to a story telling us that the cost of war in Afghanistan soars to $2.5 billion, which is an increase of two-thirds. The paper also says that as we withdraw from Iraq, the cost of that war increased over the past year as well. The Independent leads on a story about asylum detainees who have won a record payout. It says that a family of asylum detainees whose traumatised children were unlawfully locked up for 2 months have been awarded £150,000. The Telegraph shares its front page with one story quoting a top civil servant who attacks schools policy. It quotes Professor Adrian Smith, who says the government's concentrating on the masses at the expense of the brightest children. It also says that a health chief has admitted we have a two-tier health system. Finally, the Sun gives over its front page to the picture of a baby-faced father and his baby daughter, Maisie. He's 4 foot, Alfie Patton, who's become a father at only 13 when his 15-year-old girlfriend became pregnant. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
After Tim Geithner, the US Treasury Secretary, persuaded the Senate to agree to his plan to rescue the financial system earlier this week, stock markets fell sharply. And that's bad news for Geithner, whose proposals depend on the cooperation of private investors. He wants them to invest with the government in toxic debt. Andrew Clark's our business correspondent in New York. So how's it supposed to work?
Well, that's a very good question. And I must admit, I've read it about five times and I'm still not entirely clear, and neither are the people who buy and sell shares on Wall Street, hence plummeting share prices. But seriously, there are several different aspects to it. The first part is that every major bank in the US will undergo a stress test, a little bit like a medical checkup, to find out just how badly it's doing and just how many toxic assets there are on its balance sheet. And then secondly, there will be a program with about $1 trillion in it, in which the government will stand behind new loans, new mortgages, car loans, student loans, things like that. They will guarantee these new loans issued by banks. That's just in order to try and get things moving, try and encourage banks to get some more money out there into the economy. And the third part, though, is the most complicated part and the bit that nobody seems to be able to quite grasp. And this involves creating some kind of a public-private partnership, a combined entity of public and private money to suck up all the toxic assets from banks' balance sheets that are polluting things and dragging these banks underwater. And just how that is going to work is not clear. Geithner hasn't offered any details on it, and that's what's really concerning people a little bit.
Geithner has had quite a long time to get this plan together, hasn't he?
Well, he has and he hasn't. To be fair, he was only sworn in 2 weeks ago. But of course, prior to being Treasury Secretary, he was running the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and was quite closely involved with the previous Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, in the Bush administration's bailout efforts. So yes, he has had some time to think things through, but in terms of actually assembling a team and getting the details together, it's only been a few days.
Obama himself has admitted that governments are slow to respond to these rapidly developing financial crises. But, you know, what more can the government do now to win over Wall Street?
Well, I think there's certainly an increasingly vocal minority of people who are saying, look, isn't it about time we cut our losses? Should we really be using more and more taxpayers' money to keep these faltering institutions afloat? Why don't we look at these banks, decide which of them are viable and which are not, and allow the ones that aren't viable, well, perhaps take government ownership of the ones that aren't viable, reorganise them, get rid of the liabilities, sell them on, and let's have a wholesale sweeping out of this industry rather than just constantly pumping extra bits of money in to try and keep everyone happy. So really, a lot of people feeling it's time for a complete rethink and a more radical solution.
But the previous administration under George Bush came in for criticism for letting Lehman Brothers go to the wall.
Well, indeed. That was a slightly different situation because that was what was known as a disorderly bankruptcy. So it was a bank that literally ran out of money, suffered a run on its resources almost overnight over the course of a weekend, and it went to the wall. What we're talking about here is more of a managed process of appointing receivers, appointing government oversight for these banks, cleaning them up perhaps outside the public eye, away from the eyes of the market, and then seeing who survives and seeing who doesn't. So you might call it an orderly bankruptcy as opposed to a disorderly bankruptcy.
And if Geithner's plan fails to produce results, will he have to go back to Congress and ask for yet more taxpayers' money?
Well, very possibly. Interestingly, he has a little bit of a get-out clause because in this rather complex and opaque plan, there is, as we talked about, an issue of stress testing all the banks. So he's going to go into each one and see just how bad the situation is. And that perhaps gives him a get-out clause to say, well, look, we've stress-tested several of these banks and they just can't be saved. They're just in too shabby a state. So that's an interesting little piece of politics in there, I think, and it might just allow him to be a little more brutal than perhaps the headlines are suggesting.
Andrew Clark in New York. Now, what about the British government's economic policies? Gordon Brown appeared before the Commons Liaison Committee yesterday for the first time since the government's multi-billion pound bailout package was announced. Under cross-questioning from MPs, the Prime Minister defended his handling of the economic crisis, and he rebutted accusations that he was guilty of misjudgment over the appointment of the former HBOS chief, Sir James Crosby, to the Financial Services Authority.
I do accept that this is a matter of public interest, so I've checked back on the appointment of Sir James to the the board of the FSA. And remember, we're dealing with a situation here where we have allegations that have been made by one person, but these are contested allegations. But the appointment of Sir James to the board was done in a very clear way. A committee was set up to make the appointment. I, of course, as the minister, take responsibility for what happened in that year when the appointment was made, 2003.
Live blogging the two-hour session was our senior political correspondent, Andrew Sparrow.
Well, I thought he did quite well yesterday. Others felt that he'd got a bit of a rough time because there were some tricky questions from some of the Tory committee chairmen. But remember, it's a Labour-dominated committee. And my sense was that they were all quite sombre. The session was mostly about the economy. There were a few tough questions. At one point, Sir George Young, the Tory chair of the Standards and Privileges Committee, appeared to catch Brown out when he said, well, you've been telling us that countries around the world have been copying your economic policies. Name anyone else who has cut VAT, the VAT cut, which has been sort of widely criticised because it doesn't appear to have increased spending very much. And Brown was struggling for an answer on that one. But by and large, though, I felt he came over pretty well. He knew his facts. He was assured. He was confident. And he wasn't really ruffled by the questions.
How did he deal with questions over his appointment of Sir James Crosby to the FSA?
Well, this came up right at the start. This is the subject that the media had been concentrating on yesterday. So he knew it was going to come up. And it was pretty obvious he'd done his homework on this because he went into quite a lot of detail about the Crosby appointment. He sort of explained how it had happened. He named some of the people on the advisory panel that had put Crosby's name forward. He'd even sort of looked up what they'd told him. They had told him Crosby was an outstanding candidate. And at one point he used this phrase, I take full responsibility for the appointment, but he did it in classic politician speak. I take full responsibility, but I'm not to blame because I was just following someone else's advice. And he also had gone into some detail about the FSA, Financial Services Authority, and HBOS, because the allegation against Crosby is that he appointed Crosby, who had been chief executive of HBOS, to this job on the regulator at a time when other parts of the system were saying, actually, hang on, HBOS was taking all sorts of extreme risks. And he kind of went through that. He listed the various reports that had been. He said the situation had been improving. He'd said there'd been kind of 29 similar other reports. He said he hadn't been aware of them at the time that Crosby had first been appointed. So he did a reasonably good job of trying to distance himself from that.
How did Brown deal with another issue that's causing a lot of anger at the moment, the issue of city bonuses?
He had something quite explicit to say on this. Remember, up till now, Brown has basically been outflanked by the Tories and certainly by the Liberal Democrats on city bonuses. He's been reluctant to demand an end to bonuses or a sort of vigorous clampdown because he's got city bankers telling him, look, you bought these banks, they're full of people who depend on bonuses. If you cut their bonuses, they're all going to go off, work for someone else, and you're going to have a bank, sort of a pretty worthless bank when you try and sell it a few years down the line. So up till now, he's been sort of relatively cautious, but he said a couple of things quite specific. He said he wanted to end the risk culture, but where people were getting bonuses for taking short-term risks. He said that before, but he also, and this was new, he introduced the idea of people having the money clawed back. If they did a deal, got a bonus, the deal went wrong, he suggested they should have to pay the money back. Whether that's feasible or not, I'm not entirely sure. People have been raising questions about that because people have employment contracts and so on. But it's certainly an interesting idea. He also made it clear that when the FSA produces a report, as it's going to before the budget, and we found out the budget's going to be on April the 22nd, it's going to suggest changing the regulatory regime. So banks that appear to be paying excessive bonuses to risk takers get more tightly regulated. Brown said he's going to legislate on that as soon as he gets the chance.
Brown also said that there'd be a new train contract to a British-led consortium that would create 12,500 jobs. The Department of Transport later said that these jobs would be created or safeguarded, so some of the jobs may exist already. And then it later transpired that some of the jobs won't even be in Britain.
Yes, this was interesting because it's a huge figure, that $7.5 billion. I was listening to the hearing and I heard that and I thought, well, actually, hang on, how come that's not leading the news if it really is as good as it sounds? It's also over a very, very long period of time. So there definitely will be some benefit to British industry, but it's not as if £7.5 billion is going to be spent tomorrow creating, as you say, 12,000 new jobs.
Andy Sparrow, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website today, video of a house that was transformed from a drafty ecological nightmare to a low-carbon dream home with gas bills of 50 quid a year at guardian.co.uk/environment. Nazir Ahmed on why he asked the Home Office to ban the Dutch race-hate extremist Geert Wilders from Britain. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. And plain crazy, we celebrate 40 years of the jumbo jet at guardian.co.uk/arts. Now we continue our series of secular essays from The Guardian's Comment is Free website, inspired by the BBC's Thought for the Day, but without the religious element. Today, Jonathan Bartley, co-director of the religious think tank Ecclesia and a columnist for the Church Times, on children.
Psychohistorian Lloyd DeMouse has said that the history of childhood is a nightmare from which we are only just awakening. We are still to fully emerge from our slumber if last week's report by the Children's Society is anything to go by. This week, it will be debated in the House of Lords. But this may be as much a part of the problem as a move towards a solution. Another case of policymakers debating what we should do about or even to our children, rather than allowing children themselves to have a direct say in their own destinies. Which is ironic, because the whole point of the Children's Society's latest project was to hear what children were saying, to give them a voice. The report related their experiences and stories, their own accounts of what they thought should happen to them. The Second Chamber of Parliament has a reputation for a membership located at the other end of life's journey. But children are excluded from participation in many other social institutions too. Something that would just not be tolerated on the basis of gender, class, sexual orientation, race or disability. This paternalistic model aims to variously protect, educate and control children. But an alternative approach is to admit them to full participation in our decision-making structures, acknowledging that they have something important to contribute, just like everyone else. It's a crying shame that we don't do it. Children can often pose the most simple, but also profound and important questions that adults are afraid, or too caught up in the complexities of issues, to ask. Opponents, of course, will argue that they aren't able to concentrate, that they don't know enough, or that involving them is just impractical. But it's not a matter of co-opting them into the robust argument of their elders. Rather, we need new spaces and mechanisms to empower them to speak as children. They should be allowed to influence the way we interact and debate. Breaking highbrow discussions down into terms that are more accessible is a practice from which everyone benefits. It brings accountability with the values of differing positions laid bare for all to see. It's time to make our institutions age inclusive. And we could start with the House of Lords. Who knows, the persistent impatience of youth might even be the catalyst we need to finally get a timetable for its long-awaited reform.
Jonathan Bartley, and you can hear more in our series Another Thought for the Day, produced in association with the Humanist Society of Scotland, at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. I'm John Dennis, still to come in Guardian Daily. The Pope moves to reassure Jews offended by his readmission to the church of a bishop who denies the Holocaust. But first, after the Israeli election earlier this week failed to produce a clear winner, the leaders of the largest parties, Zippy Lifni and Benjamin Netanyahu, are locked in talks with the smaller parties. And the far-right leader, Avigdor Lieberman, could prove key in whoever manages to form a coalition. Rory McCarthy's in Jerusalem with the latest developments.
Well, we're still in the early stages of this. There's essentially a political deadlock. Both Zippy Lifni of the Kadima Party and Benjamin Netanyahu of Likud are having a series of private meetings with all the different political parties in Israel, making offers, negotiating, trying to entice them into coalition governments. There will be several more days of this, at least another week of this, before it becomes clear who is most likely to emerge as the future prime minister. I think that most people expect that Netanyahu is more likely to emerge with a coalition government, even though he came second in the election. He's more likely to come out on top simply because the right-wing parties as a whole did better in these elections and he will turn to them for support.
The easiest option would be for Netanyahu to form a right-wing coalition with Lieberman. What's stopping him?
That would be his easiest option. He could form a coalition with Lieberman and with some of the other smaller right-wing parties. I think, and he would get a majority doing that. I think that's not his ideal path to take because he's anxious that a narrow right-wing government, even a very right-wing government, would go down very badly internationally, particularly with the Obama administration, which has said that it wants to aggressively pursue a peace in the Middle East. All Israeli politicians know that a close relationship with the Americans is crucial. And I think Netanyahu might be a bit anxious that a very right-wing, a narrow right-wing government might jeopardize that relationship.
There was a higher than expected turnout in this election, but do Israeli voters feel any satisfaction with this muddled outcome?
There are a lot of questions being asked at the moment about the electoral system in Israel. It's a system of proportional representation where you vote for a party list. And there hasn't been, I mean, these tend to produce coalition governments, which generally tend to be unstable. I mean, Zippy Livni of the Kadima Party won this election, and she won 20 seats in the Knesset. Now, the Knesset has 120 seats. You can see she's still a very long way from having a majority herself. So I think there's frustration about that. I think there's also frustration that there isn't one decent leader in this country that people really feel profoundly attracted to or supportive of. I spoke to many voters who said they couldn't decide between the parties. They thought that the main parties had policy platforms that were almost identical, and there wasn't really much for them to choose from.
Rory McCarthy in Jerusalem. The Catholic Church is profoundly and irrevocably committed to reject all anti-Semitism. That's what the Pope told Jewish leaders yesterday in an attempt to defuse the offence he caused by his decision to readmit to the church a rebel bishop who denies that 6 million Jews were killed by the Nazis. The Guardian's John Hooper is in Rome.
He was addressing a group of visiting American Jewish leaders and clearly wanting to bury this whole controversy over the lifting of the excommunication of a renegade bishop who is also a Holocaust denier. The Pope went further than he has gone before. He said that it was his fervent prayer that the memory of this appalling crime, is what he called the Nazi Holocaust, will strengthen our determination to heal the wounds that for too long have sullied relations between Christians and Jews. And in a gesture that clearly impressed the American leaders, he said that he took as his own a prayer that the late Pope John Paul II used when he was in Jerusalem, in which he asked for forgiveness from the Jews for Christians who'd been persecuted, the Christians who had persecuted them in past centuries.
What were the reasons, John, for the Pope's lifting of the excommunication of this dissident, Holocaust-denying bishop, Richard Williamson?
One of the central aims of his papacy has been to try to reintegrate the traditionalists who drifted away from the Roman Catholic Church after the Second Vatican Council in protest of the reforms that the Council introduced. And he therefore felt that by lifting the excommunication, he would give himself the grounds on which talks could be built for a full integration, a full communion with this group. The problem, as one of the American Jewish leaders said after meeting the Pope, is that this move had unintended consequences. It is bringing back into the fold a group of people among whom there are many who hold deeply anti-Semitic views.
The Pope's planning to visit Israel in May. How far has this meeting with the American Jewish delegation gone to easing the fears of Jews around the world about this current Pope's attitude towards the Holocaust and Jews in general?
What's happened has not stood in the way of the visit to Israel going ahead. In fact, one of the things that's come out is a confirmation by the Pope for the first time that he is planning to visit Israel, though no date was stated for that. It's probably going to be in May. And the leaders of the delegation were quite adamant that the whole affair would not stand in the way of the development of relations between the Vatican and Israel.
John Hooper, Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.